Bienvenue sur Radio Créum. Welcome to Radio Créum. This is a special recording of the Breaking the Silence Conference on the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada that took place at the University of Montreal on September 26th and 27th in 2008. You will now hear part 9 of the recording, which features a fourth panel hosted by Marianne Stenbeck on Memory, Truth and Reconciliation with Sue Campbell, Roger Simon and Robina Thomas.
Hello, welcome to this afternoon's session entitled Memory, Truth and Reconciliation. If I presume you already know that there are translation devices that you can get over here, which will give you English and French. I know at least one person this afternoon will probably speak in French. Alors, je vous souhaite la bienvenue pour la session de cet après-midi. And I think we should start right away with Sue Campbell, who is here to my right. Sue Campbell is a professor of philosophy at Dalhousie University. On the theme of memory, she is currently co-editing a volume on embodiment and agency and has published Relational Remembering, Rethinking the Memory Wars at Rowan and Littlefield Publishers in 2003. I apologize, my voice is a bit rough. I've just come back from the Arctic and there we are. And numerous articles on the subject, including The Second Voice in Memory Studies in 2008. She also has published Inside the Frame of the Past, Memory, Diversity and Solidarity in the forthcoming volume she's co-editing on Embodiment and Agency at Penn State University Press. Remembering Who We Are, Responsibility and Resistant Identification in a forthcoming volume edited by David Hakon Kim, titled Passions of the Color Line, Emotion and Power in Racial Construction at SUNY Press. She also has published A Singular and Representative Life, Personal Memory and Systemic Harms in the Canadian Journal of Philosophy. It all sounds like a wonderful introduction to her talk this afternoon. Please, Sue.
Thanks. My head is so full of thoughts from the last day and a half that I'm actually hoping words will come out of my mouth. I am deeply honored to be here talking to you, and I want to situate myself as a non-Indigenous Canadian who is deeply committed to the work of the TRC and is trying to think about how those of us who participate as non-Indigenous Canadians participate from where we are and what we do. I do work on memory, and I would also like to acknowledge with gratitude that this work on memory has been encouraged by people in this room, including Paulette Regan, Cyril Sunga, and others, and I am grateful for that as well. The theme of my talk is who can share memory? And I want to raise that as a question that is both, I think, relevant for the work of the TRC, certainly relevant for the participation of non-Indigenous Canadians in this work, and also relevant, I think, for trying to understand some of the deep harm of policies of genocide and cultural assimilation that characterized the residential schooling. So in my work, I think about memory, particularly in how people share memory of harm in political contexts. And I'm interested in what we need to actually understand about memory and our conceptions of memory and how we might need to change those. Am I talking at an okay pace? I'm a little nervous. Okay. Okay. And so today I want to talk about how we is meant to challenge non-Indigenous Canadians might need to think about memory and to think about our conceptions of memory in the context of the work of the TRC. For me, TRCs are a lot about memory. Students, former students, their families and communities will be sharing their memories. Also, it's hoped that Canadian public memory will shift, but it's hoped that I think that individuals, non-Indigenous Canadians, will remember and experience their own past and their own sense of their own heritage differently. I believe that the basis for this hope is that sharing experience and memory is not just how we convey information about the past, but is one of the most profound and fundamental ways in which we actually shape relation with each other. So what are the possibilities for shaping relation through sharing memory? How are those possibilities politically structured? Not just through a context like the TRC, but much more broadly and systematically. I believe that how we understand what it is to remember, the values of memory, who has the power to enforce certain conceptions of memory, and how those with power position others as rememberers and try to structure who they can share memory with and what about, those conceptions and those exercises of power are deeply implicated in political harms. I want to think about how we might encourage different ways of sharing memory. I think that that's important to the possibility of political repair. In order to participate in renewing relation with recognition and respect for Aboriginal cultural and legal traditions, non-Indigenous Canadians need to think through how the structuring of memory relations, who could share memory with who, was part of the practice of the attempted genocide of Indigenous peoples, and we need to work to restructure our memory relations with attention to the role that they actually played, and I would suggest are still playing, in those processes of assimilation. Okay. So I want to situate this challenge for non-Indigenous Canadian public, of whom I am one, more concretely around the discussion of Prime Minister Harper's apology. And so the quote on the PowerPoint, I'm using PowerPoints just to show words that are not my own, and sometimes I wouldn't want them to be. Prime Minister Harper made a link between the apology and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, both in the throne speech in the actual apology itself. And I've entitled the slide Apology and Closure? Our government recently concluded a final settlement on Indian residential schools and will launch a commission for truth and reconciliation. The Prime Minister, on behalf of our government, will use this occasion to make a statement of apology to close this sad chapter in our history. So this link between the apology and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. On the one hand, you have the idea of launching a commission while you're closing a chapter in history. And it seems to me that there's something very temporally awkward the way that this has been stated. So the link is made, but it's not made in ways that one sees remembering as a forward-looking activity through the apology and through the work of the TRC. Now, in the actual apology, it concluded by talking about the commission, and the Prime Minister here acknowledged, as is not acknowledged here, the years of work and activism by survivors, communities, and Aboriginal organizations, suggesting the apology as a step in a process of renewing relations that would require non-Indigenous Canadians to gain knowledge and understanding of our history as settlers and colonizers. So opening up towards the TRC. What I did in preparation for today, what I did in preparation for today is that there were 100 pages of comments to the Globe and Mail after the apology, and I read 50. And what I was doing was I was actually looking for a link. I was looking for a link between the apology as a necessary expression of being responsible and the idea of living out the apology, partly through gaining understanding and fostering more respectful relations through participation in sharing experience and sharing memory in the context of the TRC. And I, in fact, did not find that link. So in these 50 pages of comments that I read, and many of them were very much in support of the apology, there was this great gap. People said things like, "Now to the future. I think the apology was a long time coming. I realize nothing we will do will atone for past sins, but at least we are acknowledging wrongdoing. At some point, we need to look forward, not constantly backwards, and hopefully this is a starting point forward." So I was looking for a link between the apology and the living out of the apology in the TRC through the sharing of memory as forward-looking. But instead, even for people who supported the apology, non-Indigenous people writing to the Globe and Mail, I just simply found an absence there. And that concerned me very much. I didn't find the link. I found the opposition of looking forward and looking back, where memory remains a kind of looking back. Okay, so slide three. So what I did not find in the non-Indigenous response was the idea of a living past. That for the First Peoples of Canada, the past cannot be forgotten, deliberately overlooked, or discarded as no longer relevant. The past is still present, but in a different form that must be addressed again and again in the conditions in which it appears, now and into the future. And the next slide. The approach of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples to the passage of time does not necessarily assume the finality of historical events. The effects of the past linger that are difficult to explain in languages that are based around ideas of temporal lineality. Linearity? Whatever. Okay, so what I found in the comments to the Globe and Mail was this idea of a kind of line. Time is a line where you can either look backwards and have memory, or you can look forwards, but physically, emotionally, intellectually, you can't do both at the same time. And that seems to me a very Western kind of conception of memory, which I think is shifting, but I don't think is actually shifting very fast. And so to use Jeff's words from yesterday, which I like so much, rather than learning to live in a longer now, as the Task Force on Aboriginal Cultures and Languages suggests, is a part of Indigenous cultures, in the Western response, I think you get a kind of confusion about how it's possible to do that. And that makes you wonder if what reconciliation truly does amount to, and this is a quote from Rebecca Tusosi about a Native approach to reparation, says, "The non-Indian claims to want a reconciliation, by which they mean a final effort to put the past where it belongs." So I think that there's something deeply problematic in this conception of memory that still dominates Western thinking as a kind of looking back where you can't look forward at the same time, rather than thinking of the past as a living presence around you. Now, I said that link disturbed me, and I want to try and say a little bit more now about why, in the context of thinking about residential schooling. Unless we can make the connection between how we share memory and how we shape relation in a forward-looking sense, which is what I found an absence, I don't think that non-Indigenous Canadians will be able to understand the full harm of residential schooling or the nature of assimilation. And In fact, I don't think that we'll be able to understand, not only so as not to repeat those harms, but we won't even be able to understand well enough to see what our current implication still is in colonizing relationships directed at assimilation. So now I want to think a little bit about relations of memory in the context of residential schooling. So slide 6. And I have to actually just stop here. I know it was a long morning for people. Am I still speaking to you okay, so that people can follow what I'm saying? All right. So what I think people need to do are think about memory, conceptions of memory, of who can remember and share memory, and that's fundamental in understanding the harms of residential schooling. So first of all, residential schooling was an assimilationist policy, as an assimilation policy, depended on the disruption of intergenerational remembering through the exploitation of children as particularly vulnerable rememberers. It was an explicitly articulated strategy to destroy cultural identities through severing children's memories from their communal support. So it was to use children as an exploitative tool to destroy cultural identities because it was thought that their memories were vulnerable to change and a kind of manipulation. It was assumed that by the government and churches that without the reinforcing context of home and family life, children would quickly forget their cultural past and be unable to carry them forward into the future, and in fact, that they would remember their own pasts through teachings that degraded their families, their nations, and their ways of being. Moreover, I think that within residential schools, I think this was not just intergenerational disruption, but within residential schools, looking through the lens of memory, as I tend to do, segregation by gender and the forbidding of indigenous languages were further ways of actually preventing the sharing of family memory within the context of those schools or of trying to do so. I think that the structuring of who can share what kind of memory, I think, is very kind of core to the policy. I also think that while children were exploited as vulnerable rememberers, their parents and elders were profoundly disrespected as people who could remember through Indian residential schooling, that they were marked as those whose memories and heritage were not a valuable resource for their descendants, as those who could not share memory. In this way, they were denied what Iris Marion Young has called the deeply human value of preservation, their capacities to convey their experience and their knowledge through intergenerational teaching. Now, the value of preservation was one of the guiding principles of the Task Force on Aboriginal Languages and Culture. We believe that each generation of speakers carries the responsibility for preserving and revitalizing the unique and irreplaceable values, spiritual and traditional beliefs, and sacred ceremonies. Iris Marion Young, who is a feminist philosopher, talks about this value of preservation specifically as a kind of intergenerational remembrance and a kind of remembrance for the future. She also talks about it as a deeply human value, and in being denied that position as rememberers through residential schooling, I want to suggest that the policy was also a policy that attempted to deny and thus dehumanize elders and parents and the communities of the children by denying them the opportunities to share memory, not only to share stories, but also to share teachings, ceremonies, and all of the other ways in which we convey intergenerational memory to each other. Now, I've said something about how I think that if we can't understand Non-Indigenous Canadians can't understand how deeply relations of memory are implicated in the harms of assimilation and cultural genocide, that what we're not also likely to understand is our current complicity in relations of memory that are still colonizing and assimilationist. elders and parents were stereotyped as the frozen past, as people who could not share memory in any meaningful way. Part of the legacy of residential schooling is the persistence of this stereotype of the frozen past, that memory that cannot be shared. And I believe that that stereotype is reinforced when non-Indigenous Canadians claim that Indigenous peoples should just get over it, get on with it, or move forward. For me, this can be read as non-Indigenous Canadians usually reminding each other that Indigenous peoples are in the past, so reinvoking that vicious and dehumanizing stereotype. And as an injunction to Indigenous peoples, it seems to me it's meant to be self-defeating or even self-annihilating in a very strong sense. That is, having been identified with the past, the injunction then to get over it is to forsake one's heritage and responsibility and its responsibilities of preservation. So simply put, I see it as another demand for assimilation. Now, I started out by saying that I, or maybe I forgot to, but I'll say it now, that our conceptions of memory are deeply political conceptions. One of the things that I want to say about the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is that what non-Indigenous Canadians have to understand not only is that profound disrespect, but that in the context of the TRC, Indigenous peoples will publicly act to reinforce the structure and flow of intergenerational memory critical to the well-being of families and to the preservation of identity, community, and nation, the very process that residential schooling sought to disrupt. So that I think that the activism and support for this TRC amongst Indigenous communities, I see the kinds of memory possibilities of this TRC as being a very powerful kind of political act. Am I doing all right for time so far? All right, I want to say just two more things now. I've said that our views of memory are not politically, or tried to argue to you that our views of memory are not politically neutral, and that to express respect, non-Indigenous Canadians need to think and enlarge their own understandings of memory. And I want to, last slide. Okay, the vibrant and complex traditions and practices of remembering of oral cultures are not the perspective where some of those practices, where those practices are embodied, ceremonial, oral, other practices of teaching and learning. These are not, that they're not the perspective from which Western theorists, who have an influence on how Western people think, they're not the perspective from which we've shaped our models of memory. And I want to actually say, rather, the recording and describing of the practices of oral traditions as past, unrecoverably past, including their practices of memory, has been a significant part of the attempted colonization of Indigenous peoples. In many Western writings, and in the Western writings on memory with which I'm quite familiar, you see oral memory practices are situated of the past, as if they're no longer memory practices at all, as a piece of situating oral cultures in which practices of oral memory are central to a sense of cultural distinctness, integrity, and nationhood, as themselves having passed, as being frozen in time or lost to progress. And so I've just actually put up a quote here from a very influential book on remembering, where a theorist is talking about theories of memory, and she says, well, speech can preserve memories over a long period of time, it's fleeting. And so what we really need for a historical sensibility is a written historical record. And it's that kind of writing about memory, I believe, that then makes one think that what one can do is close a book on a chapter in the past. Now, I've spent some of my time in the thinking about the TRC in actually trying to build positive bridges. And I think that that in fact there are positive bridges to be built. I don't want to end at in a negative note. And so I want to end by saying this. I think that non-Indigenous Canadians are capable of understanding the profound role of sharing experience and sharing memory in shaping relations. Because in fact, how we make ourselves and our own understandings of our past vulnerable to the experience that we share with others and that they share with us is a part of entering into relationships with seriousness, care, and attention. And I think that non-Indigenous Canadians can understand that from their own lives and from the relationships that they make in their lives. What I would say is that we need to make this understanding, that is, of the profound role in shaping relationships that possibilities for sharing memory play. We need to make this a much more political understanding to contribute with respect to the renewal of relationships that the TRC will envisions. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much, Sue Campbell, for a very insightful presentation. There will be questions. There will be time for questions, but the questions will come after the three speakers have spoken. We won't interrupt. Also, I forgot to introduce myself. I think I was left out of the program. My name is Marianne Stenberg. I'm a professor of cultural studies at McGill University here in town. The next speaker is Roger Simon. Roger Simon is a professor at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education, cross-appointed to the Department of Sociology and Equity Studies and the Department of Curriculum, Teaching and Learning. He is the faculty director of the Center for Media and Culture in Education and director of the Testimony and Historical Memory Project. You're a busy man. Simon has written broadly on critical approaches to culture and education. His most recent research has addressed questions of the pedagogical and ethical dimensions of practices of cultural memory in the context of our age of spectacle. This work on memory and the development of historical consciousness is part of Simon's ongoing writing and teaching, devoted to exploring the intersections of social and political theory, cultural practice, and pedagogy in regard to the project of securing a public sphere enabling a just and compassionate future society. Roger Simon, it's all yours.
Thank you. Well, like Sue, I'm very honored to be here this afternoon. I really appreciate the invitation from the people organizing this conference to have a chance to share my thoughts that are based on the work that I've been doing. In thinking about the preparation for what I would say this afternoon, I realized that I was in a very unusual position because much like published work, academic work on various truth commissions held in countries around the world, often taking the form of an assessment of commission's methods and accomplishments, I'm here addressing the possibilities and challenges faced by a newly constituted IRS-TRC. Along with my colleagues, I'm positioned here as speaking to the commissioners and members of the secretariat at the moment they're beginning to do their job. So, like others at this conference, what I want to do this afternoon is worry out loud for a while and perhaps make a suggestion or two. The commission's task is a complex undertaking with multiple purposes. However, in my comments today, I want to give priority to one specific objective, the Commission's responsibility to, quote, promote awareness and public education of Canadians about the IRS system and its impacts. So this is my attempt to make an intervention in the conversation about questions of pedagogy and education, things that I think that we have been mentioned as terribly important, but I'd like to try to push the conversation to a different level. What I'm particularly concerned, as with the truth commissions in other countries, to do this education, the TRC will no doubt have to engage in the pedagogical practice of public history. Thus, what I want to worry about this afternoon are the possible forms this public history might take, the possible pedagogies these forms embody, and some of the concerns I have about these possibilities. In discussing these issues, I want very much to raise the question of what this public history should aspire to. What notions of learning, both about and from history, of the IRS system and its impacts might the Commission attempt to engender? While I'll return to the important distinction between learning about and learning from history later on, I first need to lay out some of my presuppositions. These are presuppositions about the work of the Commission that hasn't yet taken place, so I have to make some assumptions about what I think will probably be the case. So I'm starting with the presumption that the work of the Commission will place at its center the personal and communal narratives of pain, suffering, and loss of family, friends, and cultural traditions. These will be stories of loss and abuse perpetrated not simply by specific individuals associated with the residential school system, but by government policies of assimilation that justified and put that system into place. Clearly, the hope of the Commission is that in seeking, naming, and publicly circulating this truth, this will help in rebuilding relationships among, in the Commission's words, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Canadians in ways that will foster an ethics of responsibility in which condolence and reparation will underwrite the possibility of a more just, social, and political bond. Yet my concern remains, how might one undertake a public history responsive to such aspirations? Like most of us familiar with commission reports, journalistic accounts, museum exhibitions that give priority to personal narratives in order to illustrate specific forms of violence and their consequences, likely this will be the form. One such example of this form is the report Bringing Them Home, the 1996 final report of the Australian Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, a commission of inquiry into the policies, effects, and legacy of the separation of Indigenous children from their families and communities. This report strived to educate non-Indigenous Australians about policies and practices of removal of children from their families and the harm done by these policies. While it told the story of a government policy whose purpose was assimilation and whose consequences were an attempted cultural genocide, the central pedagogical presumptions of the report lie within the excerpts of testimony by survivors of separation. While these testimonies were framed as evidence and interpreted by the report as examples of various ill effects of separation, it was the potential emotional power of the personal stories included that seemed to have provoked a charged public response in Australia. Pedagogically speaking, we actually have in Canada an equivalent to this form of public history, and I'm thinking here of the highly informative internet-based digital learning resource, Where Are the Children? Healing the Legacy of Residential Schools, which is a website that's up and running and you can access now, an educational project of the Legacy of Hope Foundation. Much of the pedagogical power of the history presented on this website rests in the mobilization of video clips of residential school survivors speaking of their experiences. So, in fact, noting that this website exists and is operating and people are accessing it means that the education about the residential schools is already starting to take place prior to the work of the commission. Contrary to the taken-for-granted effectiveness of this form of pedagogy, there are numerous scholars who have raised questions about the assumptions and consequences of this mode of pedagogy, this mode of public history. This questioning asks us to think twice about the tendency to give the stories of heartfelt pain and suffering an almost magical power, as if, as Rachel Baum says, listening to the story is enough, as if it does not take the hard work, political work, as well as emotional, to create a world in which we can truly say never again will such violence and violation be tolerated. Whether it's in regard to the experience of Jews subjected to the murderous Nazi regime, those in South Africa who experienced the violence of apartheid, or indigenous peoples of Guatemala who suffered the systematic violence perpetrated by the military junta. In myriads of texts, films, television programs, museum exhibitions, which have conveyed aspects of these singular events, it is often assumed that the best way to make such histories meaningful to their potential audiences is to provide opportunities to hear firsthand narration and personal experiences of suffering and struggle, death and resilience. Beyond juridical implications, a common assumption behind such practice is that moral conclusions leading to civic virtue are inherent in such stories, particularly so when narratives are expressively told. Indeed, this idea was quite explicitly stated in the Bringing Them Home report. Presenting an historical framing of government policies and their justification, together with Aboriginal stories of separation, loss, and what Gerald Weisenor calls survivance, the report asked that, quote, the whole community listen with an open heart and mind to the stories of what happened in the past, and having listened and understood, commit itself to reconciliation, end quote. It's from the Australian report. This request assumes that, if attended to, such narratives elicit a form of natural empathy and critical historical judgment that can lead not only to an understanding of the lives of indigenous peoples, but a restorative project within which widely diverse people work together to fulfill the requirements of a more just future. But we have to ask, what does it mean to listen with an open heart and mind? And is this affected in any way by the form of public history one chooses to undertake? Can one assume that if one speaks one's heart about one's own pain, one will be heard in a way that is both respectful of the person speaking and an opening to thought about a different collective future? As you can likely tell, the answer to this question, I think, from my tone of voice, is no. It's unwise to make this assumption. Now, this is a very difficult thing to say, because we've heard already today people speaking with from their heart and their pain and asking us to listen. And so I'm basically here raising the question, can we always make this assumption? And the fears that some survivors have about speaking to the commission in relationship to adequately being heard is part of what I'm echoing here in these concerns. So let me be specific a little bit about why we need to worry about the mode by which the commission will carry out its educational mandate. I want to briefly consider several interrelated problems that are likely to be encountered when non-Aboriginal Canadians begin listening to the stories of former students of Indian residential schools. Certainly when personal stories are intensified by affect, what is heard in these stories can be challenged in a range of ways, but not all of these ways are always positive. For example, and by the way, the issue of denial that these stories didn't happen is, I'm not even touching this. The problems I'm about to talk about are problems where it stem from the acceptance of the truth of what people are saying, but it's still processed in a different way to come to a conclusion about what is being heard that perhaps is a destructive way to think about things. Okay, so here's an example. When non-Aboriginal Canadians are presented with stories of victimization, particularly through the circulation of selected excerpts of conversations with IRS survivors, wherein specific personal and social problems are noted in order to illustrate systemic effects of residential schooling, listeners will often reduce the persona of the person to one whose life has been overdetermined by a history not of one's own making. In other words, the person is experienced as a victim deserving of pity. And clearly it is not pity that people will be asking for when they're testifying before the commission. We've heard the sentiment echoed in a variety of ways. I'm coming at it in a slightly different way. However, there is present in our society, we have to recognize this, an historically specific, socially organized mode of regarding the pain of others that has the potential to deny a person a subjectivity that is self-constituting. This is particularly troubling in the context we're discussing today, as it seems to edge towards a replay of colonial power relations. This problem can be rephrased in different terms. Within a politics of recognition, one of the things that we know can happen is misrecognition, rendering the people who come forward to speak to the commission as victims living a damaged life beyond repair risks inflicting what Dipesh Chakrabarty calls the wounds of misrecognition. In such a misrecognition, at risk is the Commission's aspiration to help Canadians recognize the unique experiences of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis, former IRS students. Indeed, it is the singularity of all former IRS students that is threatened if each story is heard as a narrative of victimization, of victimhood, and not victimization. I'll repeat that because it's so important. It's the singularity of all former IRS students is threatened if each story is heard as a narrative of victimhood and not victimization. In these instances, the singular story becomes a reiteration of what one has previously heard. All stories start to sound the same, as interchangeable, and as leading to a diminishing interest in listening and learning because there's nothing different that might be said, no further questions to be asked, nothing new to learn. In such a situation, the testimonies are no longer of equal value for the practice of public history, as they become differentially valued, not as to their truth value, but as sellable stories best suited to high-interest media broadcasts or other modes of public distribution. The circulations of story of pain and loss turn into a spectacle that diminishes the possibility of repair needed for a more just future. An additional consequence of this form of misrecognition is a dissociative splitting off in which listening accords no need to take on a sense of responsibility for a social future that would include those whose stories one is listening to. In this moment, what is forgotten is that victimhood is a position in a power relation in which one might be implicated. On quite different terms, the act of acknowledging victimhood is reduced to an affective transaction in which one both recognizes and feels for the pain of others, a situation in which there's no need to ask difficult questions that might implicate one's psychic, social, and economic investments in the conditions and institutions responsible for the genesis and prolongation of that pain. This is a problem that stems from an over-reliance on pathos, a public memory of residential schooling that relies heavily on pathos to achieve its effects risks, I think, deferring attention away from the complex nexus of policies and practices that enacted and implemented residential school legislation, as well as important questions as to what of this thinking still remains today. I know I'm treading on difficult ground here. The evocation of pathos in public history has a tendency actually to inoculate specific remembrance practices against critique as to what pedagogies they enact and what interests they serve. And yet at times, unsettling questions do need to be asked. Thus, in regard to the consequences of the over-reliance on pathos in the representation of the legacies of residential schooling, I particularly want to emphasize the problems associated with what has been acknowledged widely as the too bad, so sad syndrome. One implication of this syndrome is that it feeds the commodification of stories of suffering. Essentially, this means that when non-Aboriginal Canadians express sorrow and sympathy as a response to the anguished testimony of former residential school students, they also are confirming their own, quotes, humanitarian character, and consequently end up feeling good about feeling bad. While ethical questions can certainly be raised as to the impropriety of appropriating stories of another's pain, this is actually not the heart of the problem. When the too bad, so sad syndrome defines a response to stories of suffering, injury is recognized but there's a splitting off of any responsibility for the injury or the injured. The splitting off then serves as the justification for the refusal to give up any structural privileges accumulated over the last 250 years. In other words, this splitting off is complicit with the argument that redress of past injustice is tantamount to offering unjust advantages that are in violation of a liberal rhetoric of individual rights and equality. Now, while there remains much to discuss in regard to the problems associated with misrecognition in listening to survivor stories, I want to raise a related yet different concern that goes to the heart of what I think is a tension inherent in the multiple aims of the commission. About 10 years ago, I was engaged in a research project exploring problems associated with Canadians listening to stories of the perpetration and consequences of the systemic violence and discrimination against Indigenous peoples. In the context of this project, we chose to focus on a particular record of testimony and documentation regarding the forced removal of a particular First Nations peoples from their homelands in northwestern Manitoba to the barren shores of Hudson's Bay, and also the disastrous consequences of this move for several generations within that community. Our premise in carrying out this work was that we would pursue it as long as the First Nations community who had given witness to their stories thought that our research was of value. As we began this work, some of us came to an understanding that the problems specific to non-Indigenous Canadians listening to these stories of the community started to become apparent, and these problems were quite deep and severe. In attempting to discuss these issues with the Band Council liaison for our project, our concerns were discounted as incidental. This person, who had a prominent place in the storytelling and suffering she and her community had endured over nearly 40 years, earnestly felt that if she told her story from her heart, which is all she could really do, that it would be understood and its significance deeply felt. In this moment, we made a decision that we should bring our research project to a halt. What we concluded at that time is that the telling of the stories of pain, suffering, and death, the stories that we were hearing, was part of a process of coming to terms with the injuries suffered within a terribly unjust, violent personal and communal history. It was clear that this process required true witnesses, that is, listeners completely present to the telling of the story, completely open and supportive, recognizing that what they were receiving as a terrible gift, what they were recognizing that what they were receiving was a terrible gift as to the story's details and social significance. While on a personal level, we attempted as best we could to learn how to enact this responsibility, and I want to stress our own learning in terms of how to listen to that story. As researchers and educators interested in the public significance of her story as it circulated in print and video, we had other responsibilities, responsibilities that stem from our own insights that such learning was not easy and was very much affected by one's position in histories of colonialism and racialization. Thus, we fell into a problem. If storytellers fail to receive affirmation or legitimation from their stories, the danger is they will become further entrapped in oppressive power relations, which short circuits a process of social and psychological repair. To suggest that this woman's story might be experienced by Canadians as confusing or incomplete, or to raise questions as to the singularity of her experience and its significance for the non-Aboriginal listener, was to suggest that what was needed for the mending of storytelling to take place would not always be present in the listener. In other words, if we had persisted with our work focusing on the breakdowns in what we called ethical listening, we would have been enacting a form of violence in regard to demands and challenges of survivorship, at least for that person at that particular time. Now, my purpose in recounting this story is to stress that when stories circulate in the public domain beyond the immediate context of their telling, how they are received may be in tension with the restorative, immediate environment in which they are told. On the one hand, the Commission's mandate is to acknowledge residential school experiences, impacts, and consequences, and provide a holistic, culturally appropriate, and safe setting for former students, their families, and communities to come forward to the Commission. In this regard, the Commission has the responsibility to serve as witness, to be present and hear the enactment of the truth inherent in the telling of residential school experiences, and subsequently to ensure that the Indigenous community knows of this event and to vouch for its integrity as a moment of truth-telling. On the other hand, the Commission's mandate also includes the responsibility to provide for the public education of Canadians about the IRS system and its impacts. To do this well, the Commission must take into account that Canadians will not come upon narratives collected by the TRC as empty vessels. Whether they encounter and attend to these narratives in print, on television or radio, or perhaps on the internet or at a museum exhibition, they will have a sense of what to expect and possibly a sense of what they're expected to feel. At the very least, they will come to these stories knowing they're entering the scene of victimization. This is not to say Canadians are knowledgeable about the residential school system or the pattern of discriminatory policies that helped enact the colonization of Aboriginal peoples. Likely, they will experience many of the details as shocking and shameful. However, it's the interplay between what we know or think we know and what we don't know or don't want to know, and what we desire of and for ourselves and what we accept as our responsibilities that will shape how Canadians listen and read survivor accounts and hence what we learn in the process. While non-Aboriginal Canadians may feel sorry and sympathy for another's pain and shame, as well as hatred and disgust for the perpetrators, many will still be confused as to what they are supposed to do with the stories and consequent feelings engendered by the testimonies gathered by the Commission. Given that how people respond to testimonies addressed to them is complicated not only by cultural difference, but also by differential relationships within legacies of colonialism and racism, surely these concerns need to be considered in any public history sensitive to its pedagogical aspirations. As the Commission thinks through what it will mean to, quote, promote awareness and public education of Canadians about the IRS system and its impacts, questions of what I call remembrance pedagogy deserve some attention. So how might we begin to think about the practice of public history to anticipate and account for some of the problems I've been discussing today? A start would be to revisit what it is we want from moments when a diverse non-Aboriginal public listens to stories gathered by the TRC and subsequently contextualized and circulated in various ways via the media and other cultural institutions. One argument is that it would be desirable to have a public history structured by a pedagogy of outrage. That is, engaging a public history of residential schools, hopefully Canadians would feel the horror of a particular moment in history and become publicly shamed and enraged. Of course, as a public emotion, outrage is incredibly important in mobilizing against the arrogance of power that institutes insult and injustice. Indeed, outrage is vital in articulating a collective demand that situations of injustice stop and that restitution be made. However, the weakness in a pedagogy of outrage, particularly in relation to the remembrance associated with the IRS system, is that it allows non-Aboriginal Canadians to sit outside of relations of injustice, to observe, judge, and condemn these relations, but without considering or taking responsibility for one's implication in their reproduction. In this respect, something more than feelings of outrage are needed. One idea for the public education about the IRS and its effects is that this event should become part of the Canadian history curriculum in schools across the country. And while I support this in some respects, I want to speak a word of caution about putting too many eggs in this particular basket. I know this would be seen as one step towards the repair of a national memory that has little knowledge or understanding of state policies regarding residential schools and the consequences of these policies across generations of Indigenous peoples. But in reality, this inclusion of the history in the school curriculum is more a matter of symbolic optics, another form of state recognition, than it is a question of serious learning that requires people to come to grips with their responsibilities, if not for, at least to the legacy of residential schooling. In raising this question, I'm putting on the agenda a concern regarding the way specific practices of memory of violence and violation may or may not decouple the relationship between guilt and responsibility, and the possible consequences of this project for reconciliation. This is a question in need of much discussion, and it's unfortunate that there isn't time this afternoon to delve into this. However, if we're interested in provoking Canadians to come to grips with their responsibilities to the legacy of residential schooling, then thought needs to be given not only to what public education about the IRS entails, but as well different forms such learning might take. Thus, in my view, learning that might provoke a consideration of our responsibilities to the legacy of residential schooling would require asking non-Aboriginal Canadians to work out where we fit into Aboriginal history, not just where Aboriginal history fits into the history of Canada. This returns me to the idea I signaled at the beginning of this paper, the importance of not only learning about the IRS system, but the hard work of learning from this history. Differently from just becoming aware of the facts and consequences of residential schooling, as Deborah Britzman notes, learning from an event or an experience is a different order. It's the order that of insight, a process that asks something intimate from the learner. While Britzman importantly emphasizes interrogating one's implication in making attachments to various histories in order to better understand what makes meaning fractured, broken, or lost, what I want to emphasize is that this intimacy in learning implies the possibility of a transformative relationship that comes outside the self, in this case, the terrible gift offered by former residential school students in testifying to their experiences in the system. Beyond public history, as a matter of how the past might be accurately known and its significance assessed, there is the possibility that the work of the commission might stage an encounter with history as a force of inhabitation, a sense of dwelling with the past that implies an altered way of living with and learning from images and stories that engage one's senses of limits and possibilities, hopes and fears, identities and distinctions. One concrete version of what this might entail would be a process of reflecting on the experiences of listening to stories told by the IRSTRC, told to the IRSTRC, and retelling these stories, interweaving them with one's own life stories, so that who I am, as someone always in the process of becoming, is bound up with how it is that I will respond to the address of another. In this way, it may be possible both to acknowledge and begin to alter the particularity and anxieties associated with one's own subject position and its place in the ongoing historical power relations that are always already construct a relationship between ourselves, Canadians, and those speaking before the commission. In this sense, the insight won in the struggle to learn from history can offer a new foundation for rethinking the significance of the history of violence and violation beyond the idealizations of empathy, identification, and facile notions of solidarity. Thus, what I'm asking for here is some effort to work out the practice of public history that is enacting the circulation of stories told to the IRSTRC, a practice that would help support a reflexive ethical response wherein who I am is conditioned by my response to and for the other who speaks not for me, that is not to me and my self-interested concerns, but nevertheless to me. I'll not finish the paper, and simply say that one of the concerns that I wanted to address was the issue of working with the media. I think that the what I was about to say is that one of my suggestions for the commission was to work with Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal cultural workers, and not only in journalism but in a variety of cultural concerns, museums, literature, the arts, to think about how these stories are going to circulate. and with a clear discussion of what pedagogy should be defining and structuring these conversations. I think that it's a big mistake to talk about the media as simply providing the raw material for public conversation. The media frames the material in very significant ways. And one of the things that is a possibility that I think the commissioners might try to put some time and perhaps money into is thinking seriously about what education, public education, means in the context of circulating stories by the DRC. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Professor Simon. I think you raised many interesting questions that we'll follow up on in the question period. And now it's a real pleasure to introduce Rubina Thomas, who is from the Coast Salish Nation, assistant professor in the School of Social Work. Rubina holds a Bachelor of Social Work, a Master of Social Work, and is working towards a PhD in Indigenous Governance. Rubina is committed to First Nations education, and her research interests include storytelling, residential schools, and
age qualifying.
You heard that, right? I gave up on that. I didn't want to slaughter the word. On being Indigenous, she is committing to understanding anti-racism and anti-oppression and how these can be lived. Rubina Thomas.
Thank you. Aitsepuwaliatsiam, Antha Kultsiamat. Tenitsin Layaksin Stanemo Statlo. Haichka Tsidl Siam. Haichka Mohawk Mustimo. Haichka Mike Stand Up Delbert Sampson. For opening. So in my language, in my very, very broken Hulkamilam, I've said my name is Rubina Thomas. Kult Siamat, that's my given name. I've asked you how you're all doing, and I said thank you for being here on a Saturday afternoon. I put my hands up to you for sticking around. I also said that I'm Layaksin through marriage. Layaksin is on one of the beautiful Gulf Islands off of Vancouver Island, Valdez. But I'm Stanemo or Nanaimo, and Stalo or Chilliwack through my grandparents. I thanked the Creator for being with us here today, and for being with us all weekend. And before I presented today, I actually took a moment and asked the Creator and my ancestors to be with me here today to talk about what I'm going to talk about. I thanked the Mohawk Mastimo Haichka for allowing us to have this conference on your traditional territory and for allowing me to visit this beautiful city. And I thanked Mike Stand Up and Delbert Sampson for your absolutely wonderful words, and for bringing us to this conference in a good way, and for reminding us that we need to come to these places with our teachings, and we need to work from a place that includes the teachings that I have received from my elders, Haichka Siam. I introduced myself that way because when I was given my name, Kult Siamat, I was told that one of the reasons my aunt gave me that name was because I was working at the University of Victoria and had just accepted a position as an assistant professor. And she had huge concerns that I was going to forget where I came from. And so she said, I'm going to give you a name, Kult Siamat, and from now on you introduce yourself by that name and you'll never ever forget who you are and where you come from. And so, Antha Kult Siamat. I'm going to go back a little here and talk about June 11th, and we've talked about that a number of times today. And there was about 200 of us that gathered at the Victoria Native Friendship Center to listen to the apology. In great anticipation, you know, what would the Prime Minister have to say? And what could he say? What could he possibly say? And he said all kinds of things, but what resonated with me was when he said, regrettably, many former students are not with us today and have died having never received a full apology from the Government of Canada. As he spoke these words, all I could hear around me were the sobs. Most of them, as I looked around, were the Salkwain, the elders, crying, holding each other. And, you know, I know what they're thinking. They're thinking about all their family and friends who weren't there to hear the apology. Many of them were dressed in their traditional regalia. They came there just, you know, they were just there. We were there to make a statement. They were there to say they survived. And they were there to say, what can you possibly say to me? And I continue to wonder, you know, what we can do. That was such a tragic and sad moment for me, and it's supposed to be an apology, and it was supposed to be something meaningful, and it was supposed to make us all excited. And all I could hear was crying. And what of the apology? You know, in my small community, many people said, too little, too late. You know, this is way too late. Some people said, you know, it's all I need. You know, someone acknowledged that something happened to me, that's all I need. And many other people say that it might be a good start. You know, I hate to be cynical, but in those moments, I sat there and I wondered about of all of my relatives who, regrettably, weren't there to hear the apology. There's an obvious link between the apology and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I'll start by saying, you know, one of the part of the mandate states, there's an emergency and compelling desire to put the events of the past behind us so that we can work towards a stronger and healthier future. The truth-telling and reconciliation process as a part of an overall holistic and comprehensive response to the Indian Residential School legacy is a sincere indication and acknowledgement of the injustices and harms experienced by Aboriginal people and the need for continued healing. However, I remain really skeptical when we see words such as desire and sincere. In a mandate where the commissioners are authorized to receive statements and documents from former students, their families, communities, and all interested participants. I think that documenting testimonies or stories is a really complex process. And one of the things I want to talk about today as I carry on are the complexities of storytelling and story listening. And I also want to actually state, and as many people have stated, and I'm not going to spend as much time there as I thought I would, was talking about there's actually two very different stories that need to be told. Of course, there's the residential school stories and the stories that survivors want to tell and may tell, but there's also a Canadian story that's not been told. And it's a very different story, and it's a story of colonization, and it's a story of a partnership between the state and churches. And if these stories are not told concurrently, I really fear that the Commission's goal of establishing new relationships embedded in mutual recognition and respect will be lost. The process of freeing spirits will just never, ever happen. And reconciliation, too, will never happen. In the work that I've done, you know, I've been told that traditionally storytelling played an essential role in nurturing and educating our children. In other words, storytelling was purposeful. We always had a reason to tell a story, and we made sure our children had all the necessary stories to protect them, to guide them, and to direct them, and to live good lives. So the Commission has a huge role if they're going to take on a storytelling process and a story listening process to make sure that that process is in fact purposeful. It's an essential role in nurturing and educating, and now that nurturing and educating needs to go to the general Canadian population. I've worked with storytelling for about 10 years now, and my thesis, Storytelling in the Spirit of Wise Women, Experiences of Cooper Island Residential School, documented stories of students that went to Cooper Island Residential School. Those storytellers were my family. And in that work, the storytellers spoke about healing and the liberating nature of storytelling and how they just felt that it was such an important process for them to embark on. They shared secrets of their past, of the physical, sexual, emotional, and spiritual abuse. While they acknowledged that the storytelling process was in and of itself very healing, and it allowed them to free themselves of tragic memories of the past and move forward, they also talked about the resiliency and resistance that they needed to never ever accept what was happening to them. And yeah, they were hurt, and yeah, some of them played out some of those bad characters they picked up in those schools, but it was always a form of resistance and resiliency, and how they fought always to maintain their own ways of knowing and being and to stay rooted in their culture. But you know, I have a huge fear of these stories being documented and taken up in the wrong way. How will their stories be heard? How will those stories of my relatives be taken up? Will they be heard as stories of resistance and resiliency, or will they be doubted, questioned, and dismissed? This is why we need to be telling these two different stories at the same time. As residential schools' survivors' stories are shared, Canada has to share how they were implicit in their stories. They have to own their responsibility. One of the goals of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is to promote awareness and public education of Canadians about the Indian residential school systems and its impact. I really wonder how that goal will be met. This is an enormous responsibility. How will the people educate people who found peace on our lands, who are comfortable on our lands, and who don't want to look at that past? Paige yesterday so eloquently expressed it as, you know, how do you engage those who don't want to be engaged? And Paulette Reagan made a statement in a paper I was just reading recently in her book, soon to come. I'm always plugging for Paulette because Paulette's work is absolutely amazing. And I'm going to share one quote. She believes settlers avoid facing the hard reality and full consequences of our colonial history. The moral dilemma that confronts us in the face of Indigenous presence, we deny, minimize, and rationalize our actions in the past and the present. In this place of denial, Indigenous people are problematized and pathologized, and often the settler culture calls upon the bureaucrats to solve the problem. Similarly, as Roger said, just when he spoke, you know, that too bad, so sad syndrome. And I just truly hope that the commission is not the bureaucracy that is, and for all, and once and for all, will be the commission that will solve the Indian problem. I'm asked quite often to speak about residential schools, and it's not unusual for people to say, why can't we just move forward? That happened in the past. It's not our fault. I teach at the university in the School of Social Work, and one of the courses I teach is a core course for all social workers, and it talks about Indigenous issues in social work. Really, what I think it is, it's a history course, and it talks about the true history of Indigenous people in Canada. But to my surprise and my dismay, every year the majority of the students are unfamiliar with the stories that I share. Many of them go through enormous amounts of white guilt. Just because I'm white doesn't mean I'm a bad person. You know, those weren't my relatives. And, you know, we've talked about this today. Those aren't my, I wasn't there, it's not my responsibility. Some of them actually get to a place where they find some resolution and they realize that we know that they didn't create this policy, but that as Canadians, it's their responsibility to learn the stories and to work at a way to become an ally for our people. But I know, you know, given this, that our children are not getting this education in their K-12 education. I worked in the school system, and they're not. This isn't what they're learning. They learn a very colonial history. They learn of the wonderful things that the settlers have done, and they learn about colonization. So I struggle with the notion of promoting awareness and public education. When I work in a school that's committed to social justice anti-oppressive practice, indigenous issues, and I struggle. I wonder how we're going to do that with those that really don't care and don't really want to engage in learning. And, you know, and the other part of it that, I mean, I just couldn't go into today, but we have to acknowledge is that residential schools were implemented on a racist policy. And the reasons Canadians continue to have a too bad, so sad sense of thinking is rooted in racist ideology. And it's an issue that's going to have to be brought up in a really big way for this commission, is that we live in a fundamentally racist country. If this is truly a truth-seeking process, the commission's going to have to embark on a huge, huge education campaign. And I really liked yesterday when Eduardo expressed, you know, that one of the goals could be seen as an educational opportunity so that very few can say they didn't know. And that's my hopes, is that we might actually end up with something like that one day. I'm not going to go on and on and on because so many of the panelists have talked about this whole notion of education and awareness, and it in and of itself could take me in other directions. So I'm just going to skip over the rest of this part of this paper and do some of the things that I like more. But I want to end with a story. In his book, The Dispossessed, Jeffrey York shares a story told by Lawrence Boucher. And the story goes like this. The Indians were on this land, and the white people came from across the ocean. They came here in their boats, with their Bible, with their priest and missionaries, and they wanted to translate the Bible into Cree, and they didn't know equivalent word for sin. So they went to the elders, and they asked the elders, tell us, what is equivalent to sin in your language? The Indians didn't have a word for sin. Our children are our future. And when you shatter those lives, the lives of the children, then you shatter our future. That's the sin. Residential schools did exactly that. They shattered the lives of our children. In those institutions, our children were physically, sexually, emotionally, spiritually abused. It is now time for Canada to accept the responsibility to own their story and to tell it. Residential school survivors have been telling their stories and exposing their shame in the spirit of reciprocity. Canada needs to do the same. They need to tell its story in all of its horror. If and only if this story is exposed, will the Commission be able to move closer to rebuilding and renewing relationships between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Canadians. I really want to shift now because one of the things that I've been doing for years that I love doing is this whole notion of storytelling. I have huge concerns about how these stories will be documented and how they will be taken up. And I'm going to begin by sharing a story, and I want to first thank the survivors that are here today. And I want to thank you for sharing your stories. And I want to say to any survivors in the audience that I hope that I don't offend you with what I'm going to say. This is a story of a family member of mine that was shared with me through the process of my thesis. And one of the things, sorry, I'm getting totally distracted. I lost my pen. One of the things over the last 2 days that I've been thinking about is we're talking about abuse and we're talking about horrors. We're not telling stories. And this is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and they will be documenting stories. So this isn't a good story. The person I'm telling about is an amazing man, and I'll talk a bit about him after. Tseletse was born in Kenipsen, one of the Cowichan tribes in Duncan, and attended Cooper Island Residential School from the ages of 5 to 15. Tseletse now is a renowned Coast Salish artist and believes that it was the teachings of his Hulkwane, of his elders, that are a sacred part of his personal transformation. I was 6 years old when they brought me to Cooper Island Residential School. The first day I went to the school, I got beaten up by another Indian kid. The whole system was based on survival of the fittest. Consequently, the first thing I learned that I had to be, the first thing I learned was that I would have to fight if I wanted to be a survivor. I remember later on the first day when I finally caught up to my older brother, I said, I want to go home now. I've had it with this place. My brother said, you idiot, don't you know? We're here for the rest of our life. And I didn't believe that. I couldn't understand not being able to leave that place. One of the brothers there was a short-haired army kind of guy. He was involved in a lot of my beatings, too. I think about that. How long would you go to jail for trying to do that to a kid today, in this day and age? He punished me a lot. Once he strapped and strapped me, but I refused to cry. So he tied my hands together and hung me in a shower. As I hung there naked, he strapped me on my butt. I still wouldn't cry. He hit me a couple of times right in my privates. Jesus, you know, I thought I was gonna die. And I cried, but I couldn't cry out loud. That irked him. I couldn't stand it anymore. I was hanging there and I swear I was bleeding down below. Tears were running down my face, it hurt so badly. Then he left and was like, oh shit, you know, I'm going to die. Even then, when I was hanging there, I couldn't figure out what I did wrong to deserve such a beating. He brought in about 60 boys and marched them by me as I stood there, naked, hanging in the shower. He goes on to talk about the years of sexual abuse and beatings that he endured in that place. And you know, I would love to stand here and I'd love to say, you know, to the commission that this is a really unique story and chances are you won't hear it, but you're going to. You know, if the stories that my family had to share are similar to other residential schools, you're going to hear this story over and over and over again. When I began to do the work in storytelling and do my interviews, I thought I was really prepared. I was, you know, kind of this pesty little person when I started my research into residential school, and anyone who mentioned them, I would say, oh, can you talk to me? Will you talk to me? And I would sit and I would chat with them. I read every book I could get my hands on. I went to, you know, watched every documentary I could, and I thought I was ready. But I had no clue what were the obstacles that would lay in front of me by listening to people's stories. You know, when we talk about ethics, we often talk about issues of harm, consent, deception, privacy, confidentiality. And I agree those are issues that we should be concerned with. But I want to use Delmer's story, Saletsa's story, to discuss the ethics of storytelling from some different perspectives. Respect, relationships, responsibility, and reciprocity. And these are values that are rooted in my culture. These are values that I've been raised with and I've been taught are important. Respect is the first. I also want to acknowledge Lisa Sterling because she reminded us yesterday that this whole process has to respect our culture, our traditions, our ways of knowing and being. And they need to be rooted in our community and the protocols of our community. You know, over the years, I've come to realize that all our work must begin by respecting and honoring the voices of those whom we represent. These aren't our stories. I acknowledge that this was Delmer's story. This isn't my story. I wrote it, you know, after you know, months of interviewing. But it'll never be my story. It is Delmer's story. And we have to respect the storytellers. We have to honor them. You know, I continue to be in awe. I wasn't the best teenager, and I've done some pretty shitty things in my life, and I get ashamed to share them. But they weren't like this. They weren't these horrors. And yet, storytellers that I've worked with tell them because of the future of our people. They tell them so that their children can heal, so their grandchildren can heal. And I continue to be in awe and honor their voices. And we need to honor these stories. These are amazing stories of resistance, of resiliency. And this commission has got to honor every word that those storytellers share. We must not interpret the stories, and that's a huge fear of mine. We can't question the storytellers. We can't doubt the truth of their story. It's got to be based on the premise that those stories are true and not question the validity of their memory. And again, you know, the mandate is about truth-telling and reconciliation. Then this is what we need to do. It needs to be grounded in respect. In our language, we have a word called Aichqualoan, and that means to work with a good mind and a good heart. And all the whole process that the commission embarks on has to be based in teachings of working with a good mind and a good heart, or Kwamkwamshqualoan, a strong mind and a strong heart. Relationships. The process of storytelling has to be begin by building relationships. And this takes time, and I really worry. I don't know how many survivors will come forward. And with a five-year mandate and a report that's going to be written in 2.5 years, how much time do we have for building relationships? And you know, whoever's documenting the stories has got to spend the time to build relationships with those survivors. When I started the work that I was doing, I just witnessed the importance of relationships. I saw it unfold in front of me. The storytellers often very easily told me some of the stories that they've already been telling. And we'd go through some of those stories, and we would talk about some of the easier parts of their stories, not that any of them are easy. And then the next time we would meet, we'd kind of go back to that place. Sometimes we'd go back a little bit farther again, and then we would start to move farther into their story. And every time we met, we went through this process until they felt like they were comfortable to share with me, until they felt that they were ready to share with me. So if this is truly about truth telling, there needs to be time, and there needs to be flexibility, and the storytellers, or the story listeners, the documenters, have got to be able to spend the time. If not, all we're ever going to hear are the easy parts of the story. And that's not truly reconciliation. That's not truth-telling. Most of us know what happened in those places. So if it's going to take, the TRC's got 5 years, and we're talking about 150 years of history, I'm a little concerned. Responsibility. The mandate of the commission is based on Canada's responsibility to right the wrongs of the past. This is a huge, huge undertaking to embrace on, and especially if we want to embrace the teachings of Aichqualoan. So policies and guidelines have got to be developed so, so consciously, thinking about the responsibility. We have to be so cautious when we embark on a storytelling process, because we can never guarantee where the stories will go or what the impact will be on the storyteller. And I'll share with you, you know, one day after I'd interview Salatsa, and he shared his story of being beaten and his experience in the shower, and then later his abuse in the infirmary. And I'm driving up Island, and for those of you that don't know, absolutely, I live on the very southernmost tip. So everything in relation to me, because I live on an island, is up island and down island. And so I live on the southernmost tip of Vancouver Island, and I was going up island and to collect some more stories, to document some more stories. And all of a sudden, I was just absolutely overwhelmed with grief. And you know, I'm thinking about Celeste's story, and I watched him. I experienced the pain and the grief, the agony, the sadness, all of that. And I thought, wow, is this even ethical? You know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. Maybe I need to stop my work on my thesis and do something else. My conflict was really quickly resolved, because by the time I got home, Celeste had called me and left a message and said that, you know, that was the most painful thing he had ever gone through in his life. But he had a sense of lightness inside of his spirit, because he had finally gone back to a place and was able to tell what really happened to him there. However, we need to remember the responsibility to the storytellers through this process and be there to support them and have supports with them. I got phone calls in the middle of the night. I got, you know, phone calls day and night. I was constantly, you know, come and visit me, come and tape me, you know. So it was that absolute fluid relationship. So we need to be there for the stories once we engage in this. Another level of responsibility, I guess, is to the story listeners. I didn't know what to do. You know, I was falling apart. So there's going to be other people that are going to hear stories they've never heard before. And we at the commission has a responsibility to whoever's documenting the stories to make sure that we're there for them. And you know what? It was just the most difficult thing to do. And so when you're asking people to embark on such a scary journey, the commission just needs to ensure that that this process doesn't go sideways. And I remember Dale saying he didn't necessarily think that the Royal Commission went sideways. I do. I think it went completely sideways. And so I just hope that this isn't going sideways, and that years from now that we're not talking about some other kind of a truth and reconciliation commission or something, because this one didn't work. Reciprocity. I've always been taught that of what you take, you have to give something back. And so if we're asking survivors to share in a spirit of reciprocity so that somehow Canada can reconcile what it's done in the past, then Canada has to do their share. This has to be a really reciprocal process. And I have concerns about that. All of this needs to give something back to the survivors, and it needs to give something back to our communities. We've had too much taken from us, and we could go on and on about that, but we've had so much taken from us. You know, this process has got to give something back to our families, to our communities, to our children. And as I stated above, you know, storytelling has always been purposeful, and so I really hope that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission takes that to spirit. I'm just going to really quickly wind up here. So when I think about truth and reconciliation, you know, I keep thinking about this and I keep stumbling across this and wondering, truth and reconciliation by whom? Indigenous people have been sharing their truth for years. You know, if people really wanted to listen and really wanted to know, these stories have been around for years. No one's really cared much about them. No one's really picked up on them, but we continue to tell them. And what about reconciliation? I don't think Indigenous people have anything to reconcile. So, you know, so I think again, the commission, the onus is on the commission for truth and reconciliation. And I hope that they take that up in a good way. I've talked about storytelling, so I really want to end by talking about my family. You know, through the process of planning for this presentation and writing this paper, I've just been inundated with memories, and it's been really, really emotional. And it's hard to step out of your family and to pretend that you're coming here and delivering an academic paper, because it isn't. It's very, very spiritual. It's very, very emotional for me. And I continue to be afraid of how my stories will be listened to. And I want to talk about my late cousin, Art. When I was doing my research on residential school, my cousin, Art, who's now passed away, said to me, "Cuz, you got to keep telling those stories." And he said, "Because you can be the voices of the voiceless, those who have gone on to the other side. You were given these stories for a reason." And so I want to talk about Art. I remember like it was yesterday, August 16th and 17th, 1999. Art was suing Canada and the United Church for all of his abuse that he encountered in Port Alberni Residential School. He had asked me to come and sit with him and to be there for him and his family. Art began by sharing testimony of his lineage, both his mother's side, his father's side. He shared chieftainships, dances, songs, and names. He included both his Didi-Dat, or Nit-Nat in the Port Alberni area, and his Cowichan, or Cowichan, lineage and language and culture. These stories began to shed light on the rich and various options that were available to him had not residential school shattered his life. For 2 days, Art recounted the innumerable abuses that he endured during his years at Port Alberni. After only hours in the courtroom, I remember sitting there and I was tapping my face. Not because I was nervous, but because I had to see if what I was hearing was real. There was a moment where I just thought, you know, this can't be real. The abuses that I'm hearing could not have happened. And I was sitting there, and then I remembered that this was the second time in my life that I was actually seeing if I was conscious. The first was Delmer, the second time was my cousin Art. And I remember asking my spirit, you know, you need to sit beside me. This has to be a mental process, because I wasn't sure how my spirit was going to handle it. And I think it's so tragic to think that my spirit needed protection in that moment. Prior to Art's case, one of the offenders had been named and sentenced. And in the sentencing, Judge John Hogarth stated, "As far as victims of the accused in this matter are concerned, the Indian residential school was nothing but a form of institutionalized pedophilia. And the accused, as far as they are concerned, being children at the time, was a sexual terrorist." You know, there we were, the courtroom full of family and friends to support Art on his healing journey. And we all sat there silently with our own gazes of disbelief, sadness, and horror. But residential schools happened to our family, and they continue to affect our family today. Art claimed that an important part of his healing was telling his story and freeing his spirit. So I beg the commission in my conclusion, however you structure this work, it must be done in a way that respects the teachings of Aich Gwalawin, that frees the spirit of those who are scarred by their experiences in those institutions. And once again, I raise my hand to the survivors for your honesty and for forcing us to follow our teachings and to do what we need to do to ensure that this never, ever happens to Indigenous children again in Canada. Thank you.